This week on RSVMB Update, Mod Rahman joins us for another installment of Behind the Crown, where we talk about his journey to RuneScape and Jagex. He shares his stories and tells us how a boss is made. We also run down Garden of Carid patch notes and RuneScape outages. This is RSVMB Update, episode 910, recorded Friday, November 25th, 2022. Mod Rahman, Behind the Crown. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of RSVMB Update. This week, I have Sirion sitting in with me. Welcome.
Hello, hello, hello.
We're going to be going through some patch notes, but the thing that everybody's probably listening to this episode for, and I don't blame you for it, this has definitely been a wonderful experience in recording this. We have Mod Rahman this week for a Behind the Crown special a couple weeks ago. I was able to sit down with him, and we're bringing that Behind the Crown special to you guys this week. We had a fun discussion about a lot of things, talking about his journey with RuneScape, how he got to Jagex, and a question people have probably been wondering for a long time: how in the heck do you make a boss for RuneScape? And he's one of the perfect people to ask for that, having worked on things like Zamorak and NexAOD and Solak, just to name a few. But we got patch notes this week, and Sirion's here because it's American Thanksgiving. Good to hear from you again.
Yeah, it feels like, oh, Sirion is here. It must be Thanksgiving in America.
Yeah. We did this before.
I think this is the third year in a row or something like that.
We did this before for Needle Skips as well, because that was Thanksgiving.
Oh, was that a Thanksgiving one?
Yeah. And until some of our Elder God Wars coverage, it was the longest show ever. So this show won't fit into that category, but it'll be a good one nonetheless. You guys can follow along. Full show notes are available at update.show. You can find me in-game on Fresh Start at Shane with 3 E's or Shane12088. We also have the Friends Chat, Bits Bytes, and Sirion is just Sirion, zenning out at archaeology at some points. But let's start with patch notes this week, in particular with the Garden of Carid, because we got some changes to this, changes people have asked for, some changes that have ruffled some feathers. So just starting off... You'll see.
That's a specialty, right? Patch notes that ruffle people's feathers.
That's right. So this one, these first few don't. So they added politics, and you know, I didn't realize that until we were recording.
They added politics?
Yeah, that's
an early release of the new skill.
That's the druid's name, politics, to the NPC contact spell. So you can ask about the Garden of Carid's daily seed.
I thought it was a new skill when you said that.
No.
Politics.
No. So NPC contact allows you to get the daily seed. And a change I'd been waiting for, weeded herb patches now have a configure option so that players with the plant power upgrades can that to set a default number of seeds.
Yes.
Finally. Because, I mean, for people who have the full upgrades like myself, I'm not going to be doing anything in the future but 10. So, there we go.
Yeah, it's one of these, you know, you get better at the game and the game experience, the UI becomes worse.
Yeah, there's just so many things around the edge to tackle right?
It's. I mean, we could go about this. Like, I think the example I gave when the release first came out was like, it's the same as the archaeology shortcuts. Like, Everlight is great until you unlock like the inside area, and all of a sudden you can't just jump over the scaffolding anymore. You always have to have a second click.
Yeah,
it almost seems so weird to me when the UX starts putting up new barriers and clicks when you get better at the game. Like, I get it, but surely there's a more elegant solution to this. So,
and yeah. I don't know what that would be for this, rather than, you know, a menu when you plant herbs. So I guess that's the set default option.
At least have like right click options or something like that. Like plant 1, plant 10. Okay. I don't know.
Right, because there's no you know, plant 1 or 10 or whatever for this. It's just a configure option and plant. So
it's better than nothing.
Yeah.
I'm happy for it. I've been sticking with my 1. I don't know. The diminishing returns feel bad.
But I mean, you're still going to get more herbs at the end of the day, and that's what it's all about. So
yeah, or you could just do 10 times as many runs.
I don't think we want to do that, but in any case, adding multiple items to compost bins will now prompt the player for quantity, allowing players to place multiple items at once. Whew. I feel like this could have come out with the farming skill in 2005. But here we are.
Because this already worked with noted items. You could just throw a whole stack in. Oh, this is like, yeah, that's a good quality of life one.
Yeah, I don't have to tell you the number of times I ran back and forth between the bank to dump my hundreds of Infernus Pyroclasts in there. So now also on this, farming stores now sell bucket packs because there's an upgrade with the Garden of Charid that makes it so that you don't need to use a bucket on the compost bin or have buckets in your inventory to take compost out, and it just gives you it in a bucket. So at this point, you know, buckets are infinite basically from that. So why not just have a bucket pack?
Yeah, I don't have that upgrade, and I'm actually, you can set a game setting so that
you automatically destroy. Yeah.
Yeah, get destroyed, which is nice because with all these new herb patches, my herb run inventory is massive and I have very little space for actual herbs.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to do it, but also then I was like, but then I need to basically buy buckets every day, which I've been doing at like Tree Guy. Coden?
Yeah, or you could take a roundabout way and do what I did in the past of get your daily sand and then empty the sand buckets.
Oh, yeah. That, I guess, yeah. Anyway, this is great. This is like one of these things where you just want these items and, you know, for like some items, like the special power burst and bomb vials, I think scarcity is nice.
Yeah.
But for buckets, we really don't need a bucket scarcity in this state.
No.
Oh, can you imagine that? People like swamping their free bucket spawns because they're worth like bucket loads of money.
Oh, God. Of course. I mean, you're on the show. We should have expected a pun. And that only took you 7 minutes. So, Papa Mambo now stocks 5 vine herb seeds in his store, up from 2. And you know these are good because this is how you make juju potions, and it beats having to, you know, go stack up a whole bunch of herb lore habitat favor and then see what happens in terms of the stack of seeds you get if you want to grow any of the herbs needed for juju potions. So that's a huge win in my book. Because I actually grow my own. I think it's a goon for my juju farming potions. I have never, ever, ever, ever bought a juju farming potion.
I have never, ever, ever made a juju farming potion.
Oh, okay. All right. And instantly harvesting herbs via the farming skill cape will now display more clearly about the amount of herbs gained. And this makes sense since
That is so lovely. Like, I saw the output when using a patch bomb. Yep. It tells you exactly how much you get from like the aura and the thing. And whenever I wear the farming cape, I'm like, did it apply to bonuses? I don't know. I'm just going to assume that the game is doing the right thing, but kind of don't want to wear the farming cape because I'm not sure.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I got told numerous times about this one that it was a secret and they couldn't tell me what this was about, but a secret hidden within the Garden of Charid has had its defense requirement removed, and I wonder what that could be. The patch note says, and what this is talking about is a hidden trading sequence or similar kind of thing like that that exists in the Garden of Charid, a hidden part of that update. And that's all I'm going to say on this. If you want to know more about what that is, you can take a Google on that, and you'll mm-hmm. see what it is. Now, here's one that ruffled the feathers. Reduce the amount of thieving XP you get from pickpocketing Cruxical Knights, bringing them in line with other thieving training methods. Okay, the numbers on this brings us down to about 800k XP per hour, which puts these on par with AFK safe training in the wilderness. Active safe training is still going to beat this, but this is now on par with the AFK wilderness safe training method.
Yeah, honestly, you know, that's what the patch notes says. It brings them in line with other thieving training methods. It's pretty much exactly the same XP yeah. rates as we would expect from other training methods.
Yeah, it goes down to 800k from 1.3 mil an hour, which, I mean, yeah. is still fine.
It's still, you know, that gets you 9-to-9 thieving in not a whole lot of hours. You can do
well,
it in
it's
a day.
It's about 7 mil at that point that where you'd want to start using these, you know, from 92-ish or so, and then you could take
it. So that's like 9 hours. So, yeah. I mean, come on. Like 9 hours of watching Netflix and clicking the screen every 2 minutes or so to not log out.
And not to mention the seeds you're going to get from this, too. And
exactly.
And this is why this is important, and I know this is where you and I want to go on this, is that this adds choice in terms of, do I go do AFK safes in the wilderness, or do I go do these guys in the desert that looks a little bit nicer? And it, well, they're both new environments, of course, but when I say nicer, I mean not a hellscape. And you get seeds from this.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I can't be honestly, mad about this. And
no, and I honestly think this was the original intention, and there might be, you know, a part of thieving training, like a buff that people have been applying that they didn't expect or was easier to get to than expected. And now, like,
yeah,
you can try so many things as QA team.
Right.
And you know that the community has, like, among itself, many thousands more hours to optimize the heck out of this. Sometimes that doesn't match your expectations and you need to adjust.
Yeah, and you have to throw the entire kitchen sink at these knights in order to, you know, get the top XP rates and whatnot. It involved exoskeleton or master outfit, the relic power, the prayer and associated doing things to keep your prayer points up, or it was pretty much everything to get that 1.3 mil rate an hour on it. So, and you know, 800k for that, that's fine. It's fine now, still. So, I don't think that I have anything else left to say on this. I know there's,
there's skills that literally get you 10 times less XP per hour,
yeah.
or at least you used to.
Yeah.
Maybe not anymore. But.
Yeah.
Like,
that's true.
What are we whining about at this point?
Yeah, and you know, it raises the question, what do you do with all this XP when you have a cap of 200 mil, right?
Exactly.
So, updated the description of patch bombs to state that they will harvest a maximum of 75 crops, and they say that patch bombs have always had a maximum base number of herbs they could give when harvesting, but this was never displayed to the players. The maximum is now displayed in the items examined. Note, this is purely the base amount of herbs, excluding buffs and modifiers, and it is rare that players hit this number, even with the new plant power tiers. And, you know, I can 100% attest to this, that if you go maxed out, the average number of herbs that you expect with fully maxed setup now is around 43, 44. And then, of course, with that, you can flex up into the 50s or so. So hitting 75 is not likely.
No, and especially with those large numbers, like the deviation goes down. That's how probability
true.
Works.
True.
Yeah. Like in absolute numbers, you always
yeah.
get some hit and miss.
And I didn't think about that, but that's probably why people said that their yields don't seem to fluctuate as much now.
No. It's the law of large numbers, I think, that it's called officially.
Okay.
No, yeah, it's a really descriptive name. It's either the law of large numbers or the law of averages or something like that. I know the law of large numbers exists. I just don't know if this is the exact one, but it basically says that, you know, if you have a probabilistic process, right, the more times you repeat that, the more closer it will get to the average. So like if you flip a coin, right, if you only flip 10 times, it is still very feasible that you have like 3 times head and 7 times tails.
But right? If you flip that coin 1,000 times.
Which is like, oh, that's like, you know, like 60, no, not 60, 40% off like what you would expect. That's a really bad coin, right?
Yeah.
But it's only 2 off. If you instead would do like 1,000 times, like you are not going to see, or it's so unlikely, so much more unlikely to see like 700 times tails and 300 times heads.
Yeah, so you flip it 1,000, you're closer to that 50-50 marker you'd expect.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. That's what's happening here, right? Because you're repeating this experiment of picking herbs so many more times. It's going to get much closer to the average, and much less deviation is going to be visible.
And in this episode with basic counting with Sirion, why your herb yields look the same.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, moving on to general patch notes now. The new Master Max cape can now be placed in the player-owned house cape rack. Okay, that took a little while to do, but we welcome that. And Greater Barge will no longer sometimes increase melee attack range when using Legacy Combat Mode, and they remove some clunkiness from the Greater Barge ability, including that the Greater Barge buff is no longer lost if you click a target. Yeah, that's something. And fix some issues that prevented Greater Barge from working correctly if queued with the ability queue system. Okay. And on this note, I'd like to say that 10 years ago this past week is when EOC came out.
Wow, 10 years ago, huh?
Yep.
So, because how old is RuneScape? It's like just over 20, right?
Yeah. Well, RuneScape 2 was 2004. And then we had Classic before that, from 2001 to 2004. But yeah, the game.
So we've had since RuneScape.
We've had
2,
EOC for longer than pre EOC.
We didn't. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That is pretty surreal thinking about it that way, because it all still feels so.
It feels controversial sometimes.
Yeah, but also like, it feels so fresh still.
Yeah, that too. And
well, not well. It has many problems, but as in, you know, it. I can still very vividly remember the release of EOC.
And maybe that's just a reflection on us.
Maybe. I guess so. I guess we're getting old. We're like, remember those days? Maybe it's just
Well, there's somebody who remembers those days, and it's right up after this patch note where Tool Leprechauns will no longer note Calquit seedlings, or saplings, rather. Yeah, this was a bit numerous of us farming people just as recently as last week on this, so yay, that's been fixed. But I mentioned folks who remember the advent of EOC, and you know, when we look at who we've had before on Behind the Crown, we've had folks like Mod Shrike and Mod Stew and Mod Blackwitch, of course. But this month we sat down with Mod Ramen, and he has a very interesting story about how he found the game, how he found Jagex, and how all that has factored into his journey as a content developer at Jagex, and what that means for his own recreational RuneScape time. So we had to sit down with him, chatted with him for about an hour, 15 minutes on that, and we're very pleased to bring that chat to you right now. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another installment of Behind the Crown, and this time we're chatting with Mod Ramen. Mod Ramen is a senior content developer at Jagex on the RuneScape team. He's worked on a number of projects, including bosses, including the likes of NexAOD, Solak, most recently, of course, Zamorak, and he's also worked on everybody's favorite holiday-themed quest, Violet is Blue. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me. I've been a big follower of the podcast over the last couple of years, so really lovely to see you guys reach out.
Oh, have you? That's wonderful. That's wonderful to hear. And what we want to do with these Behind the Crown specials is, in effect, give the community a chance to know you a bit more, let you introduce yourself to the community, talk about what makes yourself passionate about working on RuneScape, and in your case, the game of RuneScape as well. And I think over the next 45 minutes to an hour or so, we'll paint a picture of that. So we're going to start off with a bit of a quick-fire question round. So what's one fact about you, Mod Ramen, the person that folks should be aware of if they're not already?
My most interesting fact, I'd say, is I didn't really pick the online tag Ramen. In fact, the way I got introduced to RuneScape was I remember trading 2 packs of Hubba Bubba, which is bubblegum, for a RuneScape account that had just full black. It had level 1 stats, everything, but it had black armor on it. And to me, that was like mind blowing. And the name of this account had Ramen in it, and therefore my name over the years evolved into Ramen. So I never got to choose my online alias. It kind of just found me.
That's amazing. Cause when you think about it, most people spend an agonizing amount of time choosing their name, but here's something you just took it in and ran with it. And I guess from that, is it worth then asking the question of your favorite ramen topping, or is that something that you even like in real life?
No, I funnily enough, just before this, I had a proper bowl of ramen. Okay. Over the years, I really got into cooking, and Japan is a love of mine. So Japanese cuisine, especially. Favorite ramen topping, you have to go with the eggs, soy soaked eggs, cooked for 6 minutes and 20 seconds. So that inside yolk is absolutely perfect. But if we're talking proper toppings, then I'd say char siu, which is rolled pork belly cooked in soy sauce and Merlin.
Okay. I have to be 100% honest in that I've never had the dish myself, but
you should absolutely get on it.
When you frame it that way, it sounds very appetizing. So I will put that on my list to try and find a good place when the opportunity arises. Do you have a favorite hobby you'd like to share with the listeners?
A favorite hobby, cooking, if you can count cooking as a hobby. Got into it a couple of years ago, properly into it, not just a casual little cooker. I'd say cooking.
All right. Your favorite book or movie, if you just had to pick one and sit down with it?
Pick one. I have an answer for both, so I'm going to say both. My favorite book is a book called Atomic Habits. More of a self-help book, but really some of the methods the guy talks about within the book has helped change and shape my life a little bit. And then favorite movie is a movie called Demolition. I think it might be Demolition Man, but I think it's just Demolition. And it stars Jake Gyllenhaal. Fantastic movie. I won't ruin the plot. But if you're looking for a bit out there movie, definitely check out Demolition.
All right, sounds good. And movies on the front have always been something that I feel are so subjective, and that's why it's always fun to ask folks what their favorite movie can be from that. And sometimes that leads to the answer of the next question, a favorite quote. Sometimes people pull their favorite quote from a book or movie. Do you have a favorite quote?
We've been having maggoty bread for 3 stinking days. It's a line from Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers.
Okay.
And it just holds a special place in my heart and my brother's, just because of just our childhood growing up together.
Okay, fair enough. That's nice, very wholesome. And of course, when you start to package all these, we get a picture of you, and we get a picture of what your personal life looks like, what your personal RuneScape experience looks like, is obviously also going to play a huge role going forward, and we want to talk a bit about some of the bosses that you've worked on. And one thing that people are probably already wondering is what is your own experience with finding RuneScape? Obviously, you mentioned finding the account with black armor on it, but how are you? Was that your first introduction to the game, or was there some other proper introduction to the game?
So I found I did have an account before I got the before I traded the bubblegum account, let's call it. So I do have my own very first personal account. I remember finding RuneScape very early on. But for me, back in, I'd say 2006, when it first started to appear on Miniclip.
Okay.
I remember exactly where I was sitting. It was a long time ago, but I can still vividly remember. I think all these memories came rushing back when we found out that Miniclip was unfortunately shutting down. And for many, Miniclip was a way of introducing people to RuneScape. So I had experience with RuneScape. I sort of dabbled in and out. I didn't really get the chance to play. Parents were very restrictive on, they didn't really understand video games. We weren't really allowed to play them. We didn't have any consoles. So finding RuneScape online on the computer, on the internet, which was accessible to us, was really my first introduction to video games, besides things like
Pokemon,
Red, Blue, on the Game Boy. So my brothers all played. I'd say I definitely played the most out of all of them. It was more less like other people where they could just sit and play and get lost in the world, and more trying to sneak onto the computer when my parents weren't looking. I remember recording like my first Halloween events, which was would have been Web of Shadows when we got Eek, or the Witch's outfit, which was the quest Swept Away. So that's around when I first started playing. And then I picked the game back up in, I'd say, 2011-ish, just after Nex had come out.
Interesting time for the game, for sure.
Oh, I think, in my personal opinion, the golden era, if I could go back to any year of RuneScape to relive and re-experience, it'd be 2011. But yeah, I remember picking up and getting membership around, 2010, 2011. And all I wanted to do was go to Nex. I remember like hosting Bandos masses to try and get leveled up, try and get gear, try and get money. And then eventually moving on to doing CoinShare Nex masses, because Nex, for some reason, just completely gripped me.
And Nex itself today is a boss, of course. It comes out for somebody's Reaper task. It's easily soloable and whatnot. But I think at the core of that, that goes back to that very essence of what drew you to Nex back in 2011, and from that maybe to other aspects of the game as well, because RuneScape is the classic thing where you set one goal and then you find, you know, five different goals along the way. Was that also part of your experience that hooked you into it?
Yeah. That and YouTube, like seeing people with, you know, their full Pernix Divine, all five manning Nex, and then you had Wooks's amazing moment where he managed to be the first to solo Nex. Seeing all these amazing feats be pulled off drew me in, made me feel that, you know, I could one day do that. I was a little far behind, and with the little amount I could actually play, I wasn't able to fulfill the destiny back then. But yeah, it was just more how RuneScape was popping up into YouTube. We had a lot of video creators back then. So I was very exposed to it, was still playing. And I don't know what it was. I think just killing bosses became an interest and a love of mine.
So would you say then that you were always a PVM RuneScape player, even going back to the core of when you made that account?
Within RuneScape, yeah. It took me a while to get to boss killing level, but just being able to go to Bandos for the first time and that being all I wanted to do, I just got hooked on Corp. We would all go to masses and you'd do like loot share masses for Corp Beast, yep, in hopes you'd find a sigil.
Because I remember when those shields came out from Corp, they were really special back in the day. Obviously, they're not as important now, but they still maintain a spot in some of the high-end tanking rotations. And that's always a neat thing to see with RuneScape bosses, how they can do that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Nex is also one that stood the test of time, but I think we've done a service to her in terms of allowing the gear she drops to remain relevant for things like masterworking,
yeah.
Gear and breaking it down into the Precilic essence.
So you started with the goal of getting to Nex and whatnot, and you built your account. I then have to ask from this. So that's how you were introduced to RuneScape. What do you currently do in RuneScape then as a player?
So I'm currently going for this. It's an interesting one because I work on the game all day.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not like frothing at the mouth to come home and absolutely grind in some hours. So I'm very much more of a casual player. If I'm playing at all, currently my goal is I'd like the master max cape, more for the master max completionist, cape. I do have a comp cape on my main. If I'm not playing that, you might catch me on my Iron Man, which is mostly PVM focused. I am nearing obtaining a max cape on it. But again, it kind of falls back to when you work on something all day.
Yeah.
RuneScape has been half my life now. My personal time needs to be something else. I cannot live and breathe RuneScape as much as I used to.
Yeah.
But I still play and I still enjoy it. I still love the game. And there are periods in my life where we go hard on RuneScape. You know, I've got a right. group of friends at work and we all love it. So sometimes over Christmas, when we all have a longer break, we're just like, right, let's absolutely session RuneScape. And we still enjoy it.
Okay. And I think that's an interesting thing to bring to the forefront, because a lot of people who know Mod Ramen, the JMod, probably also know that you have the account that's comped and whatnot, and the Iron Man that's nearly maxed for PVM and the like, or is maxed for PVM. But there's obviously something important that you highlighted there, that compartmentalization of realizing that, hey, this is my day job, but at the same time at night, we got to be very aware of the time on that front. And that's one thing that when you look at the JMods, it's kind of hard to wrap someone's head around, and I know from my own personal experience, would I want to be doing what I do during the day in my leisure time? And I think this just speaks to the passion that you need to be in the games industry, and the passion that so many people like yourself have for RuneScape, that you can still find some time alongside to sit down and enjoy RuneScape, and I think that's a very good thing that you're able to strike that balance.
Yeah, you're right. It is a balance. It's easy to burn out. It's easy to get lost in a recent update, whether it's a release or you're actually playing it. Some updates aren't received as well as others, and you can take it quite personally. Even though it's just the voice of a very loud voice of a minority. If someone doesn't like something, then they're more likely to be a bit more vocal about it. When there's other people who enjoy something, they go, yeah, that was cool, and move on to the next thing. It's easy to take things to heart and burn out and not want to interact with it, but we always come back. It's, as I said, like, it's been half my life. It's been, I don't want to say the love of my life, but it's been massive. Has truly shaped who I am and who I am going to be. And I would like to say once I leave, I would still drop in and play and maintain my completion escape. But I've never really experienced RuneScape as a player without being a staff member.
Oh,
as
interesting.
A proper maxed. Okay. Completion escape,
right?
Looking forward to upcoming content. Maybe I had about a year or two as that before I joined Jagex, but other than that, yeah, I'd like to experience that and see what it's like.
Yeah, I'd imagine that would be quite jarring, in that, like you said, it's been most of your RuneScape life you've been with Jagex at that point, and then it would probably take some time to time to get used to. And with that, it might actually raise the question. We've obviously talked about the PVM and CompCape side about this. Maybe that would lead to, oh, maybe I just want to, you know, play more casually and try a different way of gameplay. So with that, I want to ask, how did you get to that angle of choosing PVM and comp? Was it just the next angle that we talked about, or was there some other thing that influenced that along the way?
It was just the next angle, really. I remember doing, because next before Evolution and Combat was very much gear driven. You would need the small differences, like having an Onyx imbued ring for mobilizing armies. I remember doing that to get that. Needing full Pernix. So I remember slowly upgrading each piece of gear. I remember getting my first Pernix cowl, running around in a chaotic crossbow with an Eagle Eye kite shield, because I would have to sell the Divine to buy a Pernix cowl because of the expense of it all. So juggling gear, and I just enjoyed that. And then I believe Calphite King came out. And that's what really...
That was a bit after EOC, wasn't it?
It was 2013.
Okay, yeah.
January, yeah. If I remember correctly.
Yeah, the first EOC boss.
Gritty Salt. It was the first boss after.
Yeah.
Nex. There was quite a... No, QBD. I remember QBD. I remember doing QBD quite a bit, getting Royal Crossbow, and that kind of... That was just before... EOC, really. It's all a blur now.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It's all a blur. It's all condensed into one decade. But yeah, I just did solid PVM. Met a good group of people who actually introduced me to the people I knew who got me into essentially the opportunity at Jagex.
Oh, okay.
So falling in love with Nex definitely opened up the butterfly effect, as it were, opened up all the doors and put me in front of all the right people.
So. And that's where we go next. How did you get your start at Jagex? You mentioned these people that you met up with. Do you want to dive more into that, or do you just want
to... Yeah, so much to my mother's dismay, and I dropped out of... we call it college. I imagine you call it high school.
Okay.
So I didn't go into higher education. It wasn't an intentional dropout, more just laziness on my part, but didn't end up going back for, I think, my senior year or whatever the equivalent is here in Canada or the US. So I remember coming home, telling my mom I was no longer going to school anymore. And just went up to my room. I had a laptop at that point, so I had access to the internet, had access to RuneScape, had access to TeamSpeak, and I could just sit there and play the game. And that's basically what I did for a year. I was doing a lot of Nex. This sort of led into 2013. We had a TeamSpeak going, and on that team speak were some friendly J mods, Mod Crissel, Mod Slayer. And they were in a channel and they were talking to someone else and they were like, oh, hey, there's a QA position open. Talking to someone else. And I was just there sort of listening in. And I was like, why don't I go for that? So I wrote myself a cover letter, bearing in mind, you know, I had no experience, had never had a job interview before. Had never really left London before. And my sister took me on a train up to Cambridge for my first ever job interview. And I was fortunate enough to actually land the job. I don't know how. Magic, I'm not sure. Some stroke of luck.
But they must have liked what you had to say with that with that background, because in terms of all the folks we've had on Behind the Crown for, I can't say I've ever heard a Jagex origin story like this one.
Yeah, I mean, it was a proud moment, because my parents would always turn around and be like, you know, the typical trope of, that game's never going to get you anywhere in life. And one of the most the saddest moments, but also the proudest moment was just walking downstairs and telling my mom, like, hey, I got the job. And understanding where I was and how lucky I was to actually get this opportunity, went full on into putting my head down and working as hard as possible to really make this opportunity what it was to me.
So what exactly does a QA analyst do at Jagex? I know that's a bit out of the scope of where we were going, but let's just kind of paint the picture of what QA looked like for you when you started, to see where you wound up now.
So a QA analyst is essentially a tester. So back then we were called quality assurance. But a couple of years down the line, we changed to quality analyst to be a bit more industry standard.
All right.
Essentially a tester. So we would jump in as the devs are building the content, and we would go through, we'd find the bugs, we'd report them, write down all the reproduction steps, how often is this reproduced, how does the dev reproduce it, any information that would help the dev fix it, and then we would get that back as a bug. We would test the bug, test the fix, and then we'd close it off. The interesting thing about QA is they are easily the unsung heroes of the games industry, right? Because
we all know the memes that go around about Jagex QA. Like, and obviously you guys existed and exist today and have a huge role, but go ahead.
This is it. Like I was the same, right? You know, I would sit there as a player and go, oh, you know, how the f*** did this get through? Like, was this even tested? And it's like, well, okay, so that's what you see. You've seen one bug come through, right? But what you haven't seen is the hours and hours of testing that has been done prior, and all the stuff that has been stopped and hasn't gone out. All the dupes or the deletion of, I remember on the first project Mod Ryan and I worked on, which was Death of Chivalry.
Okay.
There's the section where Captain Dalston's armor is forced on the player. And what that does is that what that did prior to release, before release, it was a bug that was caught by Mod Ryan, was it would overwrite anything in that slot. So if you happened to be wearing a blue party hat, boom, deleted. And this is the stuff that gets caught, doesn't go live, but players won't ever know about that.
Yeah.
So when something does go wrong, they absolutely go off on QA. Oh, was this tested? Oh, we're the testers. And it's just like, it's a sad thing. I was the same, but my attitude changed very quickly. And they are unsung heroes. So yeah, we would essentially go through the content. We would test it. We would raise bugs. We would try and understand, okay, if you're adding to this system, what other system could that break? And this is a game that is now 20 years old,
yeah.
21, 22.
And a very bespoke game engine, too. It's not like you're working in Unreal or something that is widespread. This is Jagex's engine, and I'd imagine those quirks factor in, too.
Yep, and 20 years of different dev styles, different code styles, different people plugging into the same sort of systems. So it's a difficult beast. It's a difficult beast to tackle. But yeah, I kind of got stuck in, spent, I think, 4 or 5 years as QA, eventually moving up into senior QA along the way. But I was fortunate enough to, one of the first things I worked on and worked with when I joined was Mod Crysel's Virago.
Oh,
I remember doing playtesting.
That's another classic. This was,
you know, Mod Crysel, knowing, you know, what he did and knowing him before, actually moving into Jagex, like how much of a hero he was and is to me, is his work on Nex coming in. And I remember when he first turned around to me after a playtest and goes, hey, you're being a bit quiet. You know, what do you think? And to me, you know, this is like, it was, I can't even put it into words even today. But you know, this was one of my heroes, turning around to me and asking me what I thought about something he was working on. So I got in with the right crowd at the start, and looked up to this guy a lot, as I looked up to a lot of other people who worked there, but you know, mainly Chris L. And you can see that in the content I went on to create. But I worked with him a lot. I didn't really work with him on Rise of the Six, but then we went on to work together on bosses like Araxor, moving into Raids, which was one of Chris's last projects.
Right. Raids is one of my favorites even to today.
That's awesome. Yeah. It was a fantastic team of people. And unfortunately Chris eventually moved on to Pastures Anew. But he was a good mentor, and taught a lot of us a lot. But that's sort of how I went through QA, senior QA, and then eventually moving into a content development, which was a bit of a weird one. So
why would you say it was weird?
Because it's the way it all happened. I remember wanting to, not necessarily naively, but remember being excited about over the years in QA and senior QA, we as QA testers would have access to RuneScript. We would actually have access to the editor,
right?
And sometimes we would be able to, you know, fix our own bugs or fix a typo and actually get stuck in, learn to code. And in lunchtimes, you would have senior devs help us learn how to code. One of the amazing things at Jagex is there is a lovely mentoring attitude of devs helping QA learn how to code. And that's how a lot of, you know, myself, I think Chris also started off as a tester. Ryan started off as a tester with me. A lot of the testers that come through eventually go on to become content developers. So over lunchtimes, you know, considering I was a high school, college dropout, had no prior coding background, prior coding knowledge, would spend lunchtimes and after work just messing about, making things, making an NPC, making an NPC talk, making an NPC walk. And then one day I was like, I'm going to make an endgame boss. Now, I can imagine, you know, this young little kid who was me going to a legend of a dev and going, hey, I'm going to make a boss, an endgame boss. And they're like, sure you are. Like, I encourage that. Go nuts. Knowing that, hey, that's a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
However, perseverance, a lot of evenings, a lot of lunchtimes, I eventually got it to a point where I was like, hey, I can do this. I can do this. Remember pitching it to Dave Osborne, Mod Osborne, and he was like, yeah, I'll give you assets and time if you can deliver this. And he was supportive, helped come up with a name.
And this became AOD, right?
And this became AOD, yes. And I was adamant that we wanted to keep this secret because we were going through a time of where we would just announce something and we weren't really doing surprise content drops.
Yep.
And at the time, I was still QA, so I still had another role to fulfill and make sure I was doing my job, essentially, aside from not being a content developer, but making a boss that is a full-time job for a content developer. So continued it over lunchtimes, a little bit of work hours and evenings, and eventually we announced it in January. We had some players come in and playtest it. Nerve-wracking. One of the most nerve-wracking things I've ever done in my life, having players play your content for the first time, especially not as a content developer. But then we announced it. Players were like, oh my God, what is this? I was very specific with the way I wanted it to go out. I wanted to keep the weapons quite quiet. We were just like, oh, it's going out with just three prayers, and players on Reddit.
Right.
Like,
wow, I remember the story. You know? Yeah.
And then, you know, when it went out, they were like, oh my God, there's, you know, tier 92 weapons, and they're going absolutely bananas over it.
How big was your smile internally when you saw the players' reaction to that, given your personal experience with Nex?
One of the highlights of my life so far. is AOD's release, because of just the level of self-doubt, the level of some doubt from others, and just absolutely nailing it. It went out, and something I try and do quite often is screenshot the positive comments, because the negative can often way outshine.
Yep.
If the one negative comment, yep, can really cloud 10 really positive comments. So I got a lot of screenshots, which I sometimes go back on. You know, I've got people internally who turn around and said, "Hey, I'm proud of you. You know that?" Like, just, and for me, knowing where I came from, knowing, you know, life could have gone very different.
Yeah.
Knowing that I got a lucky break, and managed to pull something like this off was just phenomenal. And I'm very fortunate and very blessed. There was a lot of help. I wouldn't have been able to get there without, you know, the help of people like Mod Deg, Harrison, who came in and helped do the last phase of me.
Okay.
There was so much support. It wasn't just just me going. You know, I had a lot of support. A lot of time was given to me. A lot of belief was put in me. But for it to go out and be received the way it was, phenomenal. I obviously look back at it now, you know, being a content dev for 5 years, and go, wow, I would do so much differently. I actually dislike going into the code and looking at it, because everyone who does, yeah, programming,
absolutely,
looks at their first, absolutely, or any form of creative,
yeah,
looks at the first things they do, and they were like, oh my God, what was I thinking? However, it's the process, it's the journey. And it shows growth in you today. So yeah, AOD kind of paved the way. I wasn't a content dev at that point. However, it took a lot of people asking me internally, saying, "Hey, you should apply. You should apply. You should apply."
Especially when you put that frame on it that you were in QA at the time, and you created this boss that at this time has become one of RuneScape's timeless classics, I'll say. Just,
yeah.
And you know, I don't know what went into the assets and creation behind it, but one of the things also that makes AOD, in my view, is that music track that goes along with it, and it just really caps off the entire experience of what you've just described here with that. So
yeah,
that's always
music is one of the things that really make a boss, in my opinion.
Yep.
And over recent years, we've done an absolutely fantastic job. I remember giving the audio team the prompts of, "Hey, I want female vocals and 2 Steps from Hell, and I want the players to really emotionally connect with Nex, make her, like, she is a sad, tragic, you know, character at, yeah, the end of the day. Yeah, she's a badass, but also, you know, behind every badass is a lot of pain, and I wanted players to really resonate with that and understand that she isn't just this monster, and to be able to take a character that someone built up and improve upon and further the story whilst also paying homage to what they did. I feel I was able to achieve that with Nex.
So if we look at what inevitably winded up as you becoming a content developer, would you say that the inspiration for work that you do in general, do you view it like how an artist would get inspired, or do you take a more systems based approach given your past history in QA in terms of inspiring yourself?
Inspiration can come from anything. That's a big thing. I wouldn't say there is anything specific I take inspiration from. I like to look at what is missing. So if you think prior to, and we'll talk about Solak soon, I'm sure prior to Solak, all bosses kind of took place in a dungeon or a cave. Right.
Yeah.
And I think a game called Ori and the Blind Forest had come out, and it was just this beautiful but also tragic story set in this forest, and it's got orbs that glow and really bring light to this dark place. And that was something I was like, okay, RuneScape is missing this. So how can I take this sort of area and move in a direction with that, with whatever project I'm given next, which happened to be my first project as a dev, I think, besides from some Invention Batch 2 stuff, was the Lost Grove.
Okay, interesting.
And you can see if you know Ori and the Blind Forest, you're able to see the...
I think that's one of the things we put our finger on when the Lost Grove came out, if I remember going back to that. That same general sense of what you're describing. Yeah.
You can see how the music of that tells a story, a tragic story. The environment tells a story. It's just disconnected from the same sort of stuff we had just kept having over the years. Okay, here's a Slayer monster, go into a cave. Oh, it's in Curadel's cabin. Yep. It's just an extension. It's just like, in my opinion, something I've said over the years, I'm sure I'm not the first person to say it, but this is what I truly believe, is the world around you is the most important character of any game. You can have an amazing NPC or an amazing looking model and an amazing story, but in the wrong environment and it doesn't work, right? And when we talk about Violet's Blue, there's a strict rule of Violet should always stay in the Land of Snow.
Right.
Because she fits there. It's a puzzle piece, right? And she is the final puzzle piece. And if you take that puzzle piece and go to another puzzle where it's the desert, right? Take Violet as an NPC and shove her in the desert. It doesn't work.
Yeah, that wouldn't make sense.
The visuals of her doesn't tell the story of why she's in the desert. Whereas when she's in the Land of Snow and she's got her frost-tipped hair or pigtails, and she's covered up in warm furs, it tells a story. However, you can flip that and go, right, the environment is the thing that tells the story, and how do we fit things into this environment? So a lot of the time I'll take an inspiration from, hey, is something missing? Okay, how do we do this? Whether it could be a piece of music. It could be, I'm a big fan of Dave Filoni's work on Star Wars The Clone Wars. Beautiful, beautiful thing. Beautiful stories. And what he does is he took a character who was largely disliked by the Star Wars universe, the Star Wars fan base, Ahsoka Tano. And through story progression and getting the audience to connect with and go through the learnings of this character's story arc over the course of years, quickly made her one of the most loved characters within the universe. So, you know, taking inspiration from that, seeing people do things like that, and my desire to bring characters into the world where players can relate to, especially is relatability is such an important thing. Even if you introduce one character, right, and there's someone out there who relates to or loves a character, then, you know, that's job done, in my opinion.
All right.
And that's where a lot of my inspiration comes from.
And the reason I wanted to ask that is because obviously the content developer position at Jagex isn't just as we've learned through other Behind the Crowns and other talks that have been done. It's not just, here, go plug this code in, somebody else has designed that. You guys actually have to step into the design role. And I guess on the other side of that inspiration question, being an avid RuneScape player, getting started as with your role and how you were involved with Nex as a player and then moving into QA, how often do your own personal game experiences influence the design work that you do?
Quite a bit, to be honest. It depends what we're doing. Usually, as a PVMer, I definitely take learnings of how players approach bosses, not necessarily my own approach. I know what I enjoy, and I will always lean on that, because if I enjoy it, then I'm sure there are other people that enjoy it. Again, sort of on the point of, hey, what's missing? I remember early days of RuneScape, some of my fondest memories were playing holiday events, your Halloween events,
of course,
your Easter events, yep, getting the chicken outfit, getting Eek the spider, getting swept away in the broomstick and getting your goulash out the fire. It's like, these are vivid memories. And there's nothing better than coming home from, you know, school on your school Christmas break and knowing that today the RuneScape Christmas event has come out. And, you know, over the years, we've lost that. And that's where Violet is Blue sort of spawned. So again, it comes from, hey, what's missing? As a player, what do I miss?
Okay.
What brings back those memories? And how can I, as a developer, reignite that? I have the opportunity. I literally have the platform in front of me as a game developer and game designer. You're correct in pointing out that we as content developers aren't just, oh, hey, here's the design, here's the code, go do it. It's no, like, we sit there, we've been given KPIs, we've been given design aims, and then a blank piece of paper. And we have to conform to those KPIs and design names, of course. Like, it's a business, as any business, yep, does. But you are then tasked with, okay, design it, and then develop it, and then release it. And as, like, because of the three steps in this process, content development is so mentally taxing. Like, there's so much of us, so much pressure we put on ourselves because, one, we've designed it, right?
Cool. Yep.
The design has to be good. Okay, cool. Now we have to implement it, and the implementation has to be good. So there's quite a lot riding on both of those being good, and then it has to go out and players have to enjoy it. So there's so much pressure, and on release days, for me personally, I'll never forget Violet's Blue release day, or Solak release day, or Karapak release day, or Zamorak release day, because these are, you know, you sit there, and I personally, I'm shaken. I'm freaking out.
Okay. How do you get through that? Do you just have to wait? Okay.
You just have to wait. Once that timer goes down and the game reboots, you know that the next time that game comes online, the content you worked on with your whole team, it's obviously not a one-man rodeo.
Yeah.
There's a massive team behind it, but as the person who mainly did the designing and mainly did the actual code, and you're usually pushed out there as the face of this, but there is a massive team behind it, and that's always important to remember.
And that's what I wanted to get to, is that we're talking in the perspective here of you designing something, you implementing it, but most updates these days have more than one dev behind them, and of course you've got your entire team you can lean on for support and whatnot. And I just wanted to make sure that we clarified that in moving through here.
It's always worth remembering that. But yeah, so like once that timer goes down and the next time it reboots, the game is like has your design and your content, it's kind of just a waiting game. And then the comments will start to come through. And if it's a great release, it's electric. It's just you go home, and so I'll go home and I'll cry. I'll sit in the garden and I'll just burst into tears, because
aww,
the time and effort and mental tax that goes into these things, and to see it pay off, and to see, you know, Violet is Blue go out and players around the world who may not have been able to experience Christmas,
yes,
or
yeah,
our parents themselves, and or are reliving, you know, memories of doing past Christmas events. It's just like the one comment can absolutely push you over the edge. And a lot of the time, yeah, I'll sit in the garden and I'll just burst into tears, because it is overwhelming, whether it's positive or negative. But hey, like every dev goes through it. Every update we do has to go out the door. Like that reboot timer has to go on the screen at some point. And players have to go through the content at some point. So
yeah,
it's a mentally taxing job, but we all love it. So,
and you've just taken us through the process from the start through the implementation, then what it's like for an actual update to come out. I don't think many people in the player base know what you have just experienced. I certainly didn't. You've taken us through a huge range of emotions there on that, which I think is a perspective that people haven't had before. But when it comes to, let's just look at AOD for a minute here, then we'll move on to Solak. You started AOD as a passion project.
Yeah.
Did you have design goals when you imagined that in your head, or is that something that moved along over time? And that leads to a wider question. How do you design a boss? Do you just start with mechanics? Do you start with this has to fit to this combat range? Let's talk for a little bit about how you would design something.
Interesting. Yeah, so AOD actually didn't start out as Next 2. It started out as something just called Tantabus. It was just like, it was Calgaire the Warmonger. The old model. So by the time I'd started working on pre-AOD, let's call it, Calgaire the Warmonger had been graphically updated. But I still had affection for the old model. So I dug that out of the archives, the forbidden art assets. And I just plopped it down, scaled it up by, 10 times, gave it a high combat level, gave it, level 120 combat stats and plunked it down in a square arena, which was the fight kill arena, which I copied the map and shoved into my own map and was like, cool, I'm going to make a boss. And very slowly, I would just learn, okay, this is how you make a boss do X. This is how you make a boss do Y. And then one day I was just like, I'm going to make this Next 2. I'm going to make this Next hard mode specifically. However, a hard mode is usually the same boss, just a little bit harder, but I wanted something a bit different. I wanted my own mark, my own flavor in the game. So, this released in 2017. However, I likely started in 2014.
Okay.
Because it was lunchtimes and taps and afternoons and it just, and I had to learn everything. It was such a long span that halfway through, I might have just decided, oh, okay, I just want to do this. And there are so many mechanics that I did that just didn't go out just because I was just doing so much to learn at the time. And then eventually, I'll be honest, I made it up as I went along. I was like, oh, this could be cool. I'll do this. Oh, what happens if shadows appear underneath it? Or what happens if a Blood Reaver appears and paths towards the boss and it reaches the boss and the boss does damage if it reaches it. So largely for AOD, I made it all up as I went along.
Okay. Was there ever a time you wanted to put in a certain mechanic for Next, or maybe we'll touch on this for Solak, that you wanted to do but you weren't able to due to technical limitations?
That kind of comes in at Karapak.
Okay.
It depends if you want to go on to Solak next or but for AOD I largely made it up as I sort of went along. There was no strict design. I wanted to pay homage to, the original Next, and I feel like I did that successfully. So I had building blocks to go off.
Yeah, I think we'll step Solak and then into the modern Elder God Wars after that. So, and this is kind of how we get to Solak from here. What would you say the biggest learning experience you had in building AOD was that you were able to use for Solak and other subsequent bosses?
Making bosses is hard, and no matter what you design, if you give the players a door to go through, they will do everything in their power to not go through that door. So you design a mechanic with a specific way of a player dealing with it in mind, and they won't do it that way. They will do everything in their power not to. So one, don't underestimate the players.
Is this how we get to
how we get to Solak? Okay. But then even further into Solak, like, you take learnings from everything you do, and you see stuff like that appear in things like Zamorak. But like, Solak was an interesting one because after I did AOD, and then people internally said, hey, you need to apply for content dev.
Right.
Like, I was eventually did it, and then out came the Lost Grove. But when I was doing the Lost Grove, I knew in my head that I wanted to do another boss. So I sneakily got the environment for the Lost Grove with a cutout in the middle where I knew this boss arena was going to be. And it kind of, I knew that because, again, identifying, okay, what's missing? Every boss we've done in the last, I think since, when was the last boss like that was actually outside in the game world? I don't think there even maybe was one. I can't think of one.
Did Beastmaster and Yak account for that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. That's a good call out. We hadn't done many, right? And I like to see the sky, or I like to see a different environment, not just a cave wall with black going into nothing. So I knew that I wanted to do a boss, and there was nothing on the schedule. But in TAP, I had been working on something, just like it was called Nature Boss. And it was just like, oh, woods and trees and things. And then my first proper project alone as a dev was the Lost Grove Slayer Creatures. And yeah, I got the environment to have this cutout in the middle, knowing that if I ever got to do this boss, this is where it will go. And then eventually, Mod Osborne was coming around. It's like, what are we announcing at RuneFest? And I was like, hey, I've got this boss. And I'm like, maybe 30% done with it. Like, if you announce it, we could do it. And then it was announced at RuneFest.
Okay.
And then I was put on, I think I went through, I had to do a project first, which was finishing up Evil Dave's quest, which is I could do a whole podcast about, I'd love to sit down with Mod Tim and talk about Evil Dave quest, because it was just one of the wildest journeys I've ever been on, like having to pick up a project from a dev and essentially rewrite it within, you know, the span of 2 weeks.
But oh my, okay.
I had to go through that first, and then they were like, yeah, cool, now do Solak. And fortunately, I had learned a lot from AOD. I knew that I wanted to make another one of the hardest bosses in the game. I knew I really wanted to test the players. I knew I really wanted to take mechanics to the next level. And you can sort of see that with, you know, having to go into the mine realm, having to spam click things, having like the last phase, one of the last phase of Solak is one of the things I'm most proud of in the game. And I actually came up, I hadn't had the finale designed, and I was coming home from Birmingham, and for some reason I decided to walk from the train station in Cambridge, which was quite a far way to home. And I was tired, I was sleep deprived. And I remember I was about to pass out. I remember sitting down on the bench and I thought of an idea. I was like, oh, what if you go into Solak's mind?
Oh.
And I pulled out my phone and I wrote it down. And then I basically passed out. I came into work on the Monday and I had this message from myself. I was like, what if we go into Solak's mind? And then that's how the last phase came to be. And you know, when that came out, the world first race and what that actually created and how players were like, oh, how do we do this? Yep. How do we do this? And then it took 10 hours. You know, people would stream it on Twitch. We would have different perspectives. Once one team failed, you'd switch to the next Twitch stream and you'd be like, oh, they almost got it. And, you know, we finished work and we're all at home. We're all WhatsApping each other. We're like, oh my God, X, Y, or Z's team has almost got it. And then you see the world first kill actually go down and you're just like, everyone's like, yeah, you know, people on the stream are going nuts. And it's just like, okay, this is, I don't want to say calling, but I'm going to say calling. Like, this is my calling. This is what I really, truly feel passionate about. World first races are something I love.
And now we see the beginnings of Zamorak.
And now we see the beginnings of that with Zamorak and really leaning into that. Having something that is so challenging and having players progress. What I love about progression-based bosses is players will get further and further and learn something every time they do. And they'll team wipe, but every time they wipe, they learn something. And then they theory craft, or they might open up paint, and they might draw the arena, and they're all like, okay, what if we tank the boss here and move here? And then send this YZ, and, you know, they've got lines, before you know it, they've got lines all over the screen. And it's like,
it's like one of those crazy whiteboard images, right?
Yeah. That to me is gold, because it means we've done our jobs properly. We've made something that has the player's theory crafting.
Was Solak always designed to be the hardest boss in game, or did it just turn out that way?
No, it was designed to be the hardest boss in the game. I just don't, for me, I don't see the point in us going, okay, here's a bug that all players can access. It's just like, what's the point? We have all this content. Why don't we make aspirational content? Why don't we challenge the players? Constantly, we give the players power, but we don't really give anything for them to test their power against. Yeah. I don't see the point, and this is my own personal opinion. I understand I'm representing Jagex and RuneScape, but you know, I will always voice my own opinion. I don't see the point of us adding entry-level bosses. We should always be saying, okay, here's another thing. Let's keep pushing the boat out there. Let's keep seeing what we can do technically and what the players can do technically.
And I mean, even when you split it that way, you look at Zamorak, that could be an entry-level boss since it has a story mode with it. And,
And that's accessibility is still important to us. And you know, there was no... There was a design goal to say, okay, you know, make this accessible. However, it was quite a conflicting design aims for Zamorak, because it was like, okay, make this accessible, make this solo, and make this the hardest boss in the game. It's like, well, how do we make the hardest boss in the game, but also make it accessible? Those two are heavily contradicting design aims. But, you know, sitting down and going, all right, how do we do this? Okay, what have we learned from our Enrage systems?
Yeah.
So we just built something.
And that was very apparent with Zamorak, I do have to say, just looking and seeing how it's the same but different in terms of progressing along on that push.
Yeah, Zamorak was the culmination of all the learnings, right? Like, we looked at the Enrage system and goes, well, players are just going to hit 4K, so let's bring it up to 60K. Players don't like streaking systems. Okay, just do away with it. What's the point right. in adding friction, annoyances, and streaking, and players get frustrated when they die, and it's just like, forget all that. And then Elite Dungeons, right? Ambassador is my favorite boss in the game. I love it. I don't know why I love it, but I love it. But it's frustrating to me that I can't just rinse and repeat.
Right.
I have to go through this dungeon every time. So we were like, okay, why don't we say the player has to go through a dungeon X amount of times, and then they can just do it.
Yeah, and like, I mean,
give the players what they want.
On the podcast. And let them play.
Go on, sorry.
On the podcast, we joked about, oh, this is because in previously Dungeons, there was a bug where people were doing that. But from the frame you just put it here, it makes absolute sense.
Yep. And we actually fixed the bug with the update going out. But yeah, just like knowing how RuneScape players want to play, why put friction in the way, you know, and now you have players farming it, which is awesome.
So on Solak, and you know, we know the answer to this question is going to be no now, given that Solak was able to be taken down and there's a solo mode, but has it ever come across your mind as a content dev that content put out might have been too difficult when you were first seeing those early Solak reactions or Zamorak reactions, maybe? Obviously not Zamorak, because people could do it on 0%, but you know what I mean.
In my opinion is biased. I think not. If a boss comes out and it absolutely slaps up the player, I think that's okay. Because to learn how to take it down, you have to put in the hours and the effort, and you have to learn something. You have to learn how to adapt, and RuneScape players have had it so easy for so long. They've been babied and mollycoddled and just like given an easy path. And when you release bosses into the game, they should be challenging. They should walk in and go, okay, the first, you know, Solak hits, you know, 5 to 6 Ks. So the first time a player goes in, bang, you know, they're getting hit for 70% of their life.
Yeah.
Half their life. And it's just like, and the first mechanic was specifically made to wipe the whole team. Because the first thing that happens is, oh, everyone gets this 7K hit. And if one person or two people miss their pads, it's a wipe. So the first experience you get in when you go in is like, okay, this isn't going to be easy, and rightfully so. I don't think it was too hard on release. I think we listened to a lot of the vocal minority. Again, everyone's like,
right,
well, why can't I do this? Why can't I do this? It's like, well, learn how to do it.
And I mean,
like,
look at other games too. There's other veteran and very difficult content in other games that only a fraction of the player base is able to do, and this is
when you put it in that frame, that's what these bosses fit into.
Yeah. Now, obviously, we have taken learnings from Solak, and that's why Zamorak introduced a story mode or a hold your hand mode, whatever you want to call it, or starting off at zero and wage where it's easy, and then you can slowly ease your way into harder and harder and harder and harder. But in my opinion, you can look at games like World of Warcraft, where they have a normal mode, they have a heroic mode, they have a mythic mode.
Yep.
Now players don't just go into mythic mode. They learn the mechanics in normal mode, then they perfect the mechanics in heroic mode, and then they challenge themselves in mythic mode, right? And that's something I imagine we're going to move towards. I don't see us releasing something like Solak where it's just the hardest mode. Because whilst I think it's a cool idea to do, it doesn't make sense from a company's point of view to say, okay, only the top 0.5% can do this piece of content that we spend X amount of time in-house developing. You know, if you put that into, okay, there's 2 devs, 7 artists, audio, marketing.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense when you start looking at it that way, right?
Yeah, if you look at it from a cost to player interaction, it doesn't compute. However, when you say, okay, here's a story mode and here's an easy mode and this is accessible, but there's also a very hard mode for the players that want to, you know, knock themselves against the high scores. And so looking at the Zamorak high scores now, you know, the top trio now have 8,620 in rage, and they're slowly starting to slow down. So this is long form content, accessible content, farmable content, repeatable content, etc. Right. It makes sense from a business point of view to approach things like that. But on release, in my opinion, it was fine, and players just needed to learn how to do it.
All right, and this is a bit of a philosophical question, I guess. You can answer it as a developer, a player. But in your mind, what is difficulty? And the reason I think this is even a question that's worth asking is because there's a huge gap in this game between somebody who does casual Slayer combat, somebody who's going for Reaper Crew, and then the people you just mentioned who are pushing in rage at Zamorak currently. And if you were to just sum it up quickly, what is difficulty in RuneScape?
Difficulty is not putting in the time and effort. Because with RuneScape, everything is very scripted, right? Like, you can go into a boss and the same things happen at the same time, and you just need to sequence it. You just need to know how to react and engage and learn the sequencing and know that, okay, the boss is going to do this, and you have to do your own sequence against it. It's a dance, right? If your partner's out of sync, you're going to be out of sync. But can you get back in sync? Yes. So you have to go through the motions of learning how to do something and then improve. And, you know, I go back to Raksha. I love Raksha, right?
All right.
Raksha's one you can get into and really put some music on, get into the flow. It's the same thing every time. However, when I drop out the game for a couple months and then go back to Raksha, the first thing I do is probably die. And then I just need to keep going back and relearning the dance. And then, because of muscle memory, I'm just back into the swing of things.
Right. That's actually a really interesting
way of putting it. Never really wanted to get into learning things. And it's like when Raksha came out, it was a prayer switching boss. You had to be attentive.
Yeah.
And he slapped you if you didn't learn it. Now, yes, it's incredibly frustrating to die over and over, especially with the current problem in our game of death costs. Not going to go there.
That's a topic for next year.
That's a topic for next year. However, players just need to be consistent. They need to actually go to things and learn things. Things aren't difficult once you know how to do them, but players don't want to put in that effort, and that's what difficulty is to me. It might not be the answer you were looking for.
No, that's fine. I wanted an answer, an honest answer, because of your unique perspective as both a player and a content dev. That's a perspective you're not going to get anywhere else, and you don't hear day to day. So from Solak onwards, and I feel like Solak and the question of difficulty go hand in hand, and that's why it's important to have your perspective on what difficulty is as we move from Solak into something that came out this past summer, Zamorak. And with Elder God Wars Dungeon, there was a number of bosses that were released for in RuneScape, and another that you worked on was Zamorak, that had that story mode that we talked about that went all the way from story mode and beyond to zero and up to the thousands of percent in rage right now. And what were the initial design views behind the logic in that? Was it just all those learnings from AOD, from Solak, and your experience as a PVMer that led to having this huge breadth that could experience this boss, or were there other factors at play too?
There was so much that sort of went into this. We were given so many aims, and the aims actually like contradicted themselves and conflicted quite a bit. But again, you know, myself and Mud Sponge as the two devs to work on it, we knew we wanted to make something mega hard. We knew we wanted to lean on the rage system. We had seen people like Evil Lucario absolutely smash Telos over the years. We had seen people like them smash into Arglacor. And we were like, okay, well, 4K probably isn't high enough. So what happens if we uncap it? Okay, that's doable, because like in the actual code for Telos, the only reason it caps at 4K is because they didn't want to use a lot of variable space, and they didn't think players would ever hit 4K. There's a comment above it saying, caps at 4K, good luck with a winky face.
And we know how that went, eventually.
It's kind of a callback to what I said earlier. It's like, never underestimate RuneScape players, because they will prove you wrong at every turn. So we were like, okay, let's do an enrage system. All right, let's do different group sizes, because we learned from Solak, right? Solak had either two-man mode, or it had 7-man mode. And then we released scaling mode, and players were like, holy shit, this is awesome. This is fun. Like, I can now go with my mates.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry if Timmy0217 drops out, because the boss will just scale down now. So we were like, okay, let's take the best part of this. Let's take the best part of this. Let's take the best part of this. Let's not take the worst part of the enrage system, which is the streaking. Let's not take the design that, oh, all your loot gets cut in half when you die. Let's say, okay, players have complained about bad luck and going super dry on bosses, so let's add bad luck mitigation. Let's say, okay, when you get a drop, there's a nice flare, big huge animation that we know a player has got on a drop. Let's build that excitement. So we essentially looked at everything we had done over the years, and we said, let's take all the best bits, let's scrap all the worst bits, let's create a story. Like a pivotal moment, you know, you're fighting a god. So Zamorak actually came up as an idea way before we even started Elder God Wars. Okay. I remember sitting in a room with Mod Jack. It's weird that his name's Jack, because his name's actually Tim. Mod Jack and Mod Osborne, and going, what if we fight Zamorak? And they were like, oh, yeah, you know. And then this was like 2018, 2019. And think about when, you know, this actually came out so early on. So we always knew like where we were going. And when it was like, oh, we're doing a fifth boss. And I was always like, I want to do Zamorak. Let's do Zamorak. Like, let's fight a god.
And that's the PVMer and you speaking partially as well as the content dev, I'd imagine.
Yeah. And then the fifth boss, fortunately, you know, it fell on my lap, mine and Sponge's lap, and obviously an amazing team. You know, Mod Black Witch worked on that, plus a whole host of incredible people. But that's the way we started the design. We said, okay, what are players complaining about? What don't they like? What do they like? And then we were like, okay, let's really challenge the players. Let's like take these stacking mechanics where you turn on edict and you can build the boss yourself, essentially. And then when you go into the finale, we say, okay, let's reverse it. So everything you were like, oh, I don't like that one, so I'll start with that one. And then you get into the finale and it's like, huh, let's flip that on its head and see how you deal with it. And players are now like, oh, okay, well, I have to find balance. And that's the whole theme of the fight, right? You're reenacting the edicts. When anyone thinks of Gothics, they either think of green, a squiggly line some, I don't know how to describe what graphics looks like, or they say balance.
Yeah, that makes sense. And
Zamorak is the god of chaos. I wanted us to make something RuneScape hadn't really seen before and really make Zamorak dark. The chaos magic, the coven, the witches. Mod Sponge and I have an absolute affection for the coven and witch-esques and the Scarlet Witch kind of style from WandaVision. Love that sort of aesthetic. So we were like, all right, let's double down. Let's do this. Let's make this ritualistic. Let's make them summoning demons. Let's go to Infernus. Let's take all the coolest things, write them on a whiteboard, and just do it. And that's how we approached Zamorak. It was the dream, and to be able to work on something like that and say, okay, like, it's a blank slate. All we have to do is kick Zamorak off the world at the end. That's the only real storyline beat we have to hit.
And that was probably easy to do, imagining that, oh, this is a boss fight, the players are going to take it down. As long as he gets sucked away at the end when the edicts go back up, that's the storyline goals accomplished.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And so how do you, obviously, Zamorak was a learning of everything else. How do you then work on that, on the Enrage style? Because you mentioned you had the pain points of the streaking system and losing some of your loot, but how do you push the numbers beyond that 4,000 to 5,000 and so on and so forth? Is it just as simple as uncapping the limit that's there, or did you have to make certain accommodations with the boss?
No. Essentially, it was just making sure that the variable we use for Zamorak's Enrage had enough bits, so space, to go beyond 4K. So we just use a whole variable. And it was easy, because of scaling, right? Every time a one Enrage or two Enrage or three Enrage is added, every mechanic gets harder. So you don't really have to think about it in too much depth. You kind of just know that at some point this mechanic will become stronger than the players can handle, so they are going to have to readapt. But readapting, you know, maybe they start barricading for this mechanic, which means they can no longer barricade for the next mechanic. So it moves everything out of kilter.
And that was the interesting thing, because I had talked to people on release who did it in story mode and were effectively just able to revolution through it. But then you get to the 0 to 100% part of the fight where you want to start weaving in your defensives and whatnot to prolong yourself. But when you start really pushing in rage, then you get to those key edge cases, as you said, where you have to be perfect on that. And I think from a design perspective, looking at it as we did on the podcast, that's something that really ticked the box for Zamorak in terms of something that I feel that the PVM really hadn't done before on RS. So that's a positive.
The whole edicts and runes and the positive benefits and negative benefits and allowing those to stack and then reversing them made the boss. Like, because essentially when you strip back the actual mechanics that Zamorak does, is all he does is, okay, here's a big hit. Okay, how do I deal with the big hit? I can barricade. But depending on your stacks or the amount of, you know, enrage the boss has, what damage is coming through. And defensive is a whole other story, right? Like, if we hadn't done defensive penetration, then it would just be the same thing.
Yeah,
the players would deal with this boss the same way they dealt with any other boss. And they would just barricade. And then it's just like, okay, well, you know, there's no counterplay. It's just the same thing. So we had to rethink it.
And that doesn't seem fun in terms of trying to tip this boss on its head. I want to lead into your personal experience of PVM and Zamorak. Where do you stand as a player in terms of PVM difficulty from story to a certain amount of enrage about where you've got with Zamorak?
I could probably go up to 500 enrage, like, quite happily.
Okay.
Because again, it's just sequential. Knowing what to do and how to deal with things at the right time, it's absolutely fine. I can do Zamorak happily. I've got a group of friends that do it. I haven't done it much personally since release. But yeah, like I would say I'm able to do high level PVM. I'm no Lucario, but I'm able to hold my own. I enjoy it.
And that leads into the next question on this, in terms of, I guess, general PVM and boss philosophy on this. And obviously you're not going to be able to put your stamp on this, because this was Zamorak was something you were involved in, and I don't know that you'd be able to say this is the way it's going to be for all bosses going forward. But if it was your own world and you had the ability to do so, would you incorporate something like story mode all the way up to the enrage system in future bosses, so that it's open to that entire spectrum?
Yep, 100%. I think it's just a win-win. Balancing drops is the harder part for it.
Yeah.
Getting the actual enrage system and modes into bosses, easy.
All right.
And it makes it accessible, but also gives the very competent players at least a challenge. So,
and I guess where this leads to a final PBM question before we turn this on its head entirely, and you can answer this again just like the difficulty question from a dev perspective or player perspective, but what makes a boss good in your opinion?
Making the player feel powerful. Giving the player, like Karapak is a fine example, giving the player a toolkit, or allowing them to utilize the tools that they already have and are used to and know how to use in and out in a stronger method. Like, there's a someone who worked on many a boss at Blizzard on World of Warcraft. The way she put it was, I'll let you in on a secret. I don't try and make the boss kill a player. I try and make the boss die convincingly. Which is a fantastic way of putting it. It's just like, give the player power, make them feel powerful, make them hit high, make them utilize their abilities in ways they could never have dreamed of, and then make the boss die convincingly. So to answer your question, what makes a boss good? Make the player feel powerful.
And would you extend that to your opinion as a player as well, having played through RuneScape's bosses?
Absolutely.
Yep. Okay. All right.
Wonderful. There's nothing greater than absolutely smashing something down and feeling strong and having combos come together and getting lucky procs. It's super cool.
All right. And obviously, we do need to touch on everybody's favorite holiday quest, because at the time, this was something that everybody absolutely jumped up and down about when they saw it, but Violet is Blue, and we love Quest Week here at the podcast, and that quest hits so many marks. And this is something that people don't see and maybe don't appreciate about content devs at Jagex, is that one part of the year you can be working on Zamorak, but another part of a different year you're working on Violet is Blue. So how did you get Violet is Blue? Obviously, we talked about the beginnings of AOD, and we talked about the starts of Zamorak, but how did you get Violet is Blue as a project? Was it assigned to you? Did you choose it?
So myself and a dev called Mod Days, we were given the project, do a Christmas. You're doing the Christmas update. And it's like, okay, cool. What do we do? We're very retrospectively, if that's even a word, and we look back and go, okay, what have we done? What have we done wrong? How can we fix it? And we go, okay, well, let's look at Christmas. Players love Christmas events. They love holiday events.
Yep.
So let's do a holiday event. But it's such a waste of work to do all this work and then not have it persist forever. It is just a waste of assets. It's a waste of money. So let's do a quest. And it's like, okay, what do we do? And we kind of just spitball, and we're like, what if we have this little, we build a quest for someone. We already did that with, Carnelian's Rising.
Yeah.
And then slowly we sort of just developed and fleshed out this idea. And I remember the whiteboard, and we're like, let's make a story for a little girl who has parents she lives in the land of snow, and she has Yeti parents, and she's an orphan, and we want to build her the most magical Christmas. She's never experienced Christmas, so let's help her experience Christmas. And it just basically came together as quickly as that, and we were like, okay, let's do this. So we worked on the project together. It was just a absolute, you know, wonderful time. Days was, I think, transitioning into being a lead at that point, so didn't have as much time. Right. So did the I section and some other bits and bobs. And then, yeah, we released it, and that was the start of Violet is Blue. I absolutely fell in love with the character, so I was like, I really want to do a second one. So got the opportunity to do Violet's Blue too.
Such a wholesome character and such a wholesome quest. Was she designed that way, or did it kind of evolve over time that that's how her character would be?
She was designed in such a way. No, I think she just kind of evolved into that. Just the story we wrote, we never really intended it to be what it was. Players just fell in love with this character. We just told a really lovely story, and people resonated with her so well that we were like, okay, we can do that again.
Right, and whether it's the aspect of Violet is Blue from the fact that we're looking at a child through seeing Christmas for the first time, or if we're looking just through the Christmas elements to it, and that's the wonderful thing about that quest, I think, is that you're able to pull on it from so many different angles, as is the case with many RuneScape quests, that at the end of the day, it comes down to what you make from it. And the interesting part about this is that I think it's a very successful quest because it's able to still evoke those feelings, even if it's not the holiday time of year. And the reason I say that is I talk to a lot of people who just recently played through it on their fresh starts because of the XP reward at the end of it. So they're playing through this in September, October, and they're just taken back to that time in the holiday season when we're not quite there yet. And I think that speaks to the design on that. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so secluded, and it touches back on why I think, and I say, you know, Violet should never leave the land of snow, because the magic of her makes sense in her own world, right? Everything she's absolutely blown away by, oh my god, you know, so it's a wonky Christmas tree, oh my god, it's a snowman, oh my god, it's a maple syrup, like these things absolutely blow her mind. And then let's say you take her and put her in the desert and she's suddenly on Tasker's back, she's like, what?
No, that wouldn't work, would it?
She can't comprehend that, but she can't comprehend maple syrup in her own world. So the magic of Violet is her bubble and her understanding of the bubble. And you, as whether, you know, a lot of people, the demographic of RuneScape is a lot older. They're starting to have their own kids now. They're starting to, for me, you know, Christmas was a magical time. I have many siblings, and my parents put in a lot of effort around Christmas for us. So decorating the house and putting the tree up and all that stuff, like, to me, that's magical. And for me to be able to retell a story through the eyes of someone else. And it's no secret that, you know, a lot of when people write and design, they put themselves into their own characters. It's not necessarily a self-insert, but like it just naturally happens.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
So I was able to really put in the magic I felt through this character. And again, touching back on the point of people are starting to have their own kids, they're able to live out this through Violet again.
Right. Okay.
It's you're able to tell one story from so many perspectives. Like I had lovely messages on Reddit where a player's like, hey, we don't celebrate Christmas here, but it was amazing to learn about Christmas in your country. Or how you celebrate the holidays. So thank
Interesting.
You. I really felt, you know, involved in this world and attached, and I understood things and I learned everything. So it was lovely from that perspective.
And we look at the quest, of course, and it's hard to imagine getting similar feedback like that from a boss like Zamorak or Solak. Does that make changing gears at all between doing PVM updates and something like a quest difficult or moving out of what you're known for? Obviously, you're known for PBM. Is it difficult to move out of that zone as a developer and designer?
It's lovely, to be honest. It's a break. It's downtime. It's hey, I've gone from epic, cosmic, world-ending bosses and elder gods to, hey, I'm back with, you know, my pal Violet, Trevor, and Betty in the Land of Snow. And I'm able to tell a wholesome story. So you can go, yeah, as you said, like, you can go from quests and death and chaos to just putting up fairy lights, putting up a wreath, decorating a Christmas tree, talking to an imp. I personally love that. It's a breather. It's a break. You don't want to be doing the same kind of content back to back because that's what causes burnout.
Yep. Makes sense.
And whilst you're working on, you know, something like Zamorak, you might be thinking about, hey, I want to do Violet's Blue 3. And like, I would love to.
Is that a spoiler?
Well, I've been open about it, about wanting to do it. I'd like to teach Violet Halloween.
Ooh.
Do like a Nightmare Before Christmas-esque. So you're still, you know, in the Christmas theme, still right. In the Land of Snow, but you're introducing Violet to another holiday event, and we'd call it Violet's Boo, just to keep with the name. But yeah, that's my goal. I'd love to do it. I've been asking them for years. I think it's due time for another Violet quest, hopefully.
Yeah, and you're gonna get no disagreement from us on that, whether it's from the Quest Week perspective or the Violet perspective. But we've been here for a little bit more than an hour now, Mon Raman. Thank you so much for taking
no problem. Thank you for having
the time
me.
To.
As I said, big fan of the podcast. So
well, thank you.
It's an honor to be asked.
And you know, so many folks are also a big fan of what you do in the PVM space as well, and I think the thing that players are going to learn from this is just that remarkable journey that you took and how that's been able to influence everything of the bosses that you've worked on, which is a truly unique story, which is what we aim to showcase here on Behind the Crown. So thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
And I just want to thank Mon Raman again for spending some time with us. That was a very fun installment of Behind the Crown. So if you found that interesting or you liked what you had to say about that or hear about that, please do feel free to share that with your friends. And you know, we take great pleasure in bringing these to you and being able to showcase the passion of so many of the J-Mons who work on this game, that I think it's only fair that we spread that passion throughout the community and show what these folks really think and really feel as they get to sit down and become candid about their job and quite honestly candid about RuneScape in the community as well. So big thank you to Mon Raman, and hopefully you guys all enjoyed that and share it if you did. So, but before we move on and wrap up the show, I just want to actually thank some of our Patreon supporters who allow us to do things like Behind the Crown, like the monthly bits, like the roundtables, and so on and so forth. And this week, I'd like to thank Amos Reed, Andrew C., Arvids L., Beekeeper Steve, Big Huge Rat, Bryflex, Chunk the Monk, Diana, Drama Free, Duramax, Elomady, Flaws of Man, Free Milk, Jacob G., Jade Gizmo, Jason S., Jeebus, Jesse W., Keski, Ling01, Mohan V., Nate the Great, Nick G., OTR Gamer, Parnassius, Ricky A., RS Nerdherd, Samuel FL, Skiotan, Scott DS, Shirtpants, Stub Eve, The Naked Captain, Tim C., Tim M., Tom V., and Zant. Thank you, everybody. Your support truly means the world to us. And if you're wondering what all this is about, you can check us out at patreon.com/RSBNB. And there you can find the entire back catalog of 50-odd monthly bits. Right now, those are our monthly bonus shows. We're going to be recording next week the monthly bit on holiday events in RuneScape as voted by the Patreon supporters. So if that sounds interesting to you, or maybe you want to access DailyScape Part 3 or one of our tier lists on skilling or PVM or DailyScape, you can find out more about that at patreon.com/RSBNB for as little as $1 a month. And in addition to that, you'll be helping fund the cost for hosting and production of RSVNB Update. We also do have a VIP tier where you'll receive a special Discord chat channel and badge on Discord and a mention on the podcast at the start of the month, plus high-quality stereo versions of the show, in addition to everything else. And if you want to give the ultimate gift, we have the Insider tier, where you receive a shout-out on the podcast each and every week and gain exclusive access to the outtakes we use to make the clip show at the end of the year, which is coming very, very soon now. So that's going to be a fun one this year. And if any of this sounds interesting to you or you just want to support the podcast, check us out at patreon.com/RSVNB. It truly means the world to us. Thanks so much, everyone. All right. So something else happened this week that doesn't normally happen to RuneScape. The game was down for, I think it was almost 24 hours at this point, wasn't it? Or was it more than 24 hours?
It was less than 24 hours.
Okay.
They got the server up overnight.
So what happened was that on the 22nd, Tuesday, a data center in London had a site-wide issue that was based around a power failure, which caused the full downtime of any services hosted there, including RuneScape. And with this, they brought the services back online on Wednesday at 2:05 GMT. And they said, well, most of the systems have recovered. The login systems have since struggled at times. And they've identified that, and they believe going forward it won't be an issue keeping them stable. And they also say that they've... as the recovery continues, the system administrators were automatically alerted to any other outages and can restore these within minutes usually. And they say, however, and this was on Wednesday, this was posted, avoid risky activities in-game in case you log out and find yourself unable to log back in quickly on this. And this took out everything, including the website as well on this, and people, you know, had the idea of, oh, login lockout 2.0, something like that happening, something disasterly happening behind the scenes. But thankfully, I think everybody's been able to get in, and there has been no data loss on that. I know they had to restore something from backup, but I think things have recovered nicely on this. And thoughts? I don't know that I have much to say on this, except that, you know, it's good nothing was lost.
Yeah, it's interesting. It, of course, always gives an interesting insight in the architecture of companies when something like this goes down. Clearly, there's one data center that's sort of a single point of failure,
yeah,
which is problematic. And yeah, I am confident that there are currently very smart people working very hard to figure out a way around that.
And hey, just like login lockout, this is a learning experience to say that, oh, this data center is a point of failure in London, that if this goes down, everything goes down.
Yeah.
Because you don't think that a data center, like a professional data center, and for folks who aren't aware of what these are effectively big warehouses that are climate controlled that host computer servers that are connected to fast internet connections.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's very likely that they had some sort of main process running in that data server that sort of synchronized between all the game servers across the world.
Because it was old school as well.
Yeah, so maybe it's like the login servers, like the websites, are sort of like the... not the actual gameplay stuff. Like, of course, there's a lot of data centers around the world that actually handle your interaction with the game. Like RuneScape is an example of a game that is simulated entirely remotely. So whenever you click on the screen, instead of doing the stuff locally and then telling the data center, I did this, by the way, it's telling the data center, hey, I want to do this. And the data center then sends back, okay, you can do this, which is why the game feels so laggy sometimes, right? Because there's always that latency when you click something. It first needs to go to the server processes it, and then it shows you the result. So those servers exist all around the world, and they have to because you want to keep latency relatively low.
I know folks in Central America and South America had issues with that because at some point their best server was actually in Miami.
Exactly. So you notice it. My clan homeworld, our clan homeworld, is World 66. I never play on World 66 because it feels sluggish for me.
Yep.
I play on a UK-based server. So, you know, there's choices there. But of course, things like inventory, things like showing the other players' locations and all that stuff, that still needs to be synchronized between all these things. And perhaps this London data center was just responsible for that, right? It's just this hub and spoke model where all the data centers, they package up all the stuff they're doing and just synchronize that with the one server.
Yeah, and then
but if that server falls,
then if that falls down, then you're in trouble.
Exactly. Now, when the service came back online, it actually showed that UK-based worlds, they won't be online quite yet. So,
oh, interesting. I didn't see that.
Probably, what they did is they first booted up. Like, you need to imagine that these are a bit like normal computers.
Yeah, right?
And all the power went off. It is not unlikely that things like storage got lost.
Yep.
Right? At least the live active storage, because they don't really work with traditional hard disks. Mm-hmm. The process managing all the storage might have been lost, which means the storage was lost. So they kind of needed to reinstall their software on these servers and start them up. I would assume so, because otherwise the server restoration would have been much quicker.
Yeah, and you know, they actually had to send people from their technical team to the data center to, you know, oversee this sort of thing. So
I mean, I doubt that they went there with a USB stick that they plugged in. But, you know, there's also a possibility they literally went there with a USB stick.
Yeah, or hard drives or something. Who knows?
Data center security usually does not allow you to plug in a USB stick.
That's true. If you're even allowed in there as well. And, you know, for companies like Jagex, they might have agreements that would allow them into the data center. But if you and I rent a server from somewhere, we can't just walk into the data center and access it. So,
you know, you can imagine that if you need to completely set up your software stack from scratch again, that takes some time. They restored it in record time, which is good. That probably means that they have documentation about how to do this.
Probably from the learning of the login lockout.
But, like, yeah, you need to imagine that this is a data center with other customers at the same time trying to reinstall their software. There's going to be peak usage. Honestly, I'm impressed with how they solved this.
Yeah.
I think this was handled pretty well.
And the communication on this was wonderful as well. And obviously, we couldn't access the website on this, but there's an actual support article here that details every update they made, and you can scroll down to the bottom of it, and it has everything that was there. And, you know, of course, if the website was still active, this would have been a perfect way for everybody to keep up to date what was going on. So instead, the reliance was that they disseminate these, you know, through Discord and social media and whatnot, because the website was down. But after, we can see all the different updates that were posted.
One of the lessons you usually learn when you are having to run applications like this is that your status website, as well as your disaster recovery documentation, should be hosted in a completely air-gapped different place than the rest of your application. And this shows why.
Yeah.
So, I mean, honestly, I think I trust Jagex to take the lessons out of this, but, you know, I am impressed, honestly, by how quickly and how professionally they resolved this. We're going to get something made good out of this that they promised.
Yeah.
And fair enough.
You know, I
will not say no to free stuff, but at the same time, you know, this stuff happens. And
I don't know that I feel like I need this, but obviously I know many players want this. And they say before the weekend, we would like to let everybody know that we're still in the process of reviewing our make good options for the player. And next week, we'll set out and communicate our plan for this, as we're still working out some of the technical and delivery details to make this happen.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, fair enough. I mean, people pay a subscription service. They were not available for a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
There's probably customer protection laws as well that maybe require them to offer some kind of service. I don't know what the Terms of service are actually on subscriptions, if there's any.
We should read that at some point, the RuneScape Terms of Service, see if there's anything in there about that.
Yeah, that sounds like a really interesting podcast episode.
Oh, God.
I wanted to give that little bit of context for the show, because
that's good.
I think people should realize that, you know, shit happens when you're in this line of work.
And I'm just glad that this happened after the Fresh Start competitive period ended.
Oh, yeah, and after Double XP Live, right? Like, people would have been ultra mad about
it. And, you know, I took this as an opportunity, because I'd been grinding farming very heavily on this. I took this as an opportunity to take a 2-day break from the game.
Yeah, there you go.
So, we'll go through what my Fresh Start notes look like after that. But as we head into the weekend, everything seems to be A-OK game access-wise. And I mentioned Fresh Start, and just a reminder that we do have our Fresh Start Friends Chat and Clan going. The Friends Chat can be found at Bits Bytes, and the Clan is Fresh Quest. If you need a Clan for your Fresh Start adventures, just talk to anybody in there. Anybody who's ranked more than Recruit can invite. That's how I feel invites should be done in a majority of clan style systems on that. So we were able to action that. So Bitsbytes is the Friends Chat, and Fresh Quest is the clan. But we're going to go through some of our achievements this week, because we do have a collection of those on Fresh Start and Mainscape. So starting off, we have Mr. Crafty FSW with 99 Divination on the 24th. Then, also on the 24th, we have Tanis's 99 Woodcutting, Battle Slash F's 99 Herblor. Then on the 22nd, we have Fresh Soupy with 99 Strength and 99 Attack. Then on the 18th, Mr. Crafty, again, got 120 Herblor, and Fresh Soupy got 99 Constitution. Well done, everyone.
All right, well, people who haven't been playing Fresh Start Worlds, or at least have also been playing the main game, have not been sitting still, especially with Double XP Live, so got a bit of a list to go through here as well. First of all, on November 23rd, we have Lord Dustia getting 120 mining. Moving on to November 21st, we have Beekeeper Steve getting 99 thieving. Evan with 99 woodcutting. Hephaestus, but the S is a 5, 99 smithing. Lord Dustia again with 120 mining. Wait a second.
How is
shit?
I've never seen that before, where it messed up.
That's two times on different dates as well. How does it do that?
I don't know.
Well, there you go, Lord Dust. Yeah, double grats from the RSBNB crew. Lots of kisses. Mahen got 99 magic on November 21st. And Malinoric got 120 thieving. And one of a few got 99 constitution, all on November 21st. That was a busy day.
It was.
Then we got a few more achievements on November 20th. We got Fight Caves with 120 agility. Got Shaman getting 99 archaeology. Keski with 120 summoning. And Turd Sniffer Zero with 99 divination.
Then we move on to the 19th with God Shaman, who got 99 strength and 99 attack. Imperialis got 120 Herblor, Juju Makin got 99 Divination, Wolf Solo got 120 Slayer, and ZoneX 9191 got 99 Thieving. Then on the 18th, we have Beekeeper Steve with 99 Hunter, Io Messies with 120 Herblor, and Terry Dax with 99 Invention. Then wrapping it all up on the 17th, we have Fire Frit with 120 Smithing, and ZoneX 9191 with 99 Agility and 99 Slayer. But now it's time to talk about what we've been up to on RS, and I'll jump in with this because I have updates from the Fresh Start front. As you guys know, I mentioned the competitive period for Fresh Start ended, and as it ended, I finished at around, I think it was rank 23 or 24 farming. I don't remember the exact number. It's probably changed a bit since then, because I haven't really done much active farming since then. I've of course kept up the ranch and whatnot as well. Yeah, I'm on the second page now, but I finished first page I'm ranked 31 now. Not too bad for taking the foot off the gas since Monday. But I definitely finished top 100 for that. Jagex is currently vetting the high score tables, they said, and they'll have a post with all the top 100 people soon, shortly, they said. And then they'll distribute Halos after that. So I'm glad that they're vetting that because, you know, there's been lots of question about, you know, how many skills might have had infiltration by bots and such. So that's wonderful to hear. But aside from that, as I mentioned, after the servers went down, that was about, I took about a day and a half break from the game on that. And as soon as the competitive period ended on Fresh Start, take a guess what I did.
More farming?
No, I went to go do the archaeology tutorial. And with the XP modifiers we had, I got level 9 from the tutorial compared to the level 5 that you normally get, which makes sense. And I'm level 43 archaeology right now, and I've restored a grand total of 9 relics.
Oh, harassing.
I know, and this is the thing with that skill. You know, it's so reliant on the chronotes to get the upgrades and such. The skill actually breaks if you boost it too much. Because you're then getting access to things like Everlight and the higher level dig sites, but you still have the soil box that only holds 50 and all of the other base upgrades from it. The only thing you've been upgrading along the way is the Matic. So, and I say this is, this is one thing Fresh Start shows us, is that archaeology was a really well-designed skill to the point where, yes, you can boost it with bonus XP, you can boost it with lamps, you can boost it with in-game events like this, but you're going to suffer from it. So it's that choice, again, that is persistent throughout the entire skill. Do I train archaeology the regular way, or do I boost it and you know, maybe be delayed on some of my upgrades along the way? So I appreciate that in terms of the skills design, and that's an interesting thing that I've been feeling this week. But as I mentioned, up to level 43 archaeology right now. I also took some time after the game came up, and I did the quests that lead up to Menaphos, so that's Stolen Hearts, Diamond in the Rough, and Jack of Spades to unlock Acadia Trees. So with that, I got myself to 70 woodcutting with the Acadia Trees and the bank deposit box that we have. We have a portable bank deposit box that can be used once a day for an hour. So anywhere you are, you don't need to worry about porters. You just dump stuff in and away you go. Really nice on that. So 70 woodcutting. And aside from that, you know, just keeping up the player-owned farm, doing things like mushroom gathering to keep the mushroom people fed, and at this point I think it's just going to be a nice even split between archaeology and woodcutting, unless something else comes up on my radar. Maybe some divination before the XP modifiers drop, just so I can get some porters going and that sort of thing. But I know lots of people had been using their keys this week since that opened up now, and you know, it completely changes the game, we have to say, on that in terms of XP rates and just what people can do, and it's been really interesting on that front. And I'd imagine Jagex is also seeing this on the XP tables. They're also seeing it on the entire Fresh Start economy from the beginning as well. So the first 8 weeks of Fresh Start were certainly interesting and a learning experience for me, and I bet they were for Jagex as well. So I'm still very much enjoying it. But that's what I've been up to. How about you?
I don't think I've logged in the last week.
I saw you log in. You did some archaeology.
Was that this week?
Yeah, that was.
Might have been last weekend. I did some archaeology, yeah. Like you mentioned, I'm zenning archaeology. Like, I've been sort of getting back into it, basically. I have a bank full of damaged artifacts, and I kind of just want to get rid of it.
Yeah, and you're ironmanning the thing, right?
And I'm ironmanning the thing, so I'm basically gathering a whole bunch of materials. There's a few collections I need to finish, so I was going around grabbing some of the remaining artifacts that I didn't have anymore. But yeah, no, I'm slowly sort of working my way through my bank. It's sort of satisfying seeing your bank clear out, and it remains being a really good skill. My goal is basically getting it to 120 before the next skill lands, which should be doable, but we'll see.
Yeah, from my understanding of what's been hinted to, it's going to be sometime Q1.
Yeah, exactly, which means I have at least 1 month and at most 4 months, so probably somewhere in between, but
yeah,
we'll see. It's got to be tight, maybe. I might need to step up the pace a little bit, but nevertheless, I'm enjoying it. I won't grind myself out of it entirely, but it will be fun to finish that one off, and I hope the next go is just as good. But yeah, over the next few days, I'm working on the advent calendar for Clan Quest.
Oh, so right, yeah.
That's honestly where my
we talked about that at the roundtable last week.
We did talk about it. Yeah, the campaign is up by now, so donations. Yeah, you can start donating, but
and we'll have a website up. When am I getting that up by?
At the start of December, I hope.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, it will be up by the start of December.
But yeah, one entry, one cool thing, one creation by the clan every single day until Christmas, which is awesome.
And all the proceeds going to St. Jude's Children Hospital. Wonderful charity.
Exactly. So exactly. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. Third year we do this, so we're raising the bar every year, and it's tougher every year to do it, but yeah.
And I'll throw a link into the show notes for the campaign, because, you know, even if you're not part of Clan Quest, you might be interested in seeing what we have for this. So because, you know, it's just a nice general community thing that we do each and every year. So always fun to bring together the links between Clan Quest and RSBNB. So speaking of the links between Clan Quest and RSBNB and RuneScape, the RuneScape Thanksgiving stable diffusion animation has been going for about 1,100 seconds, and we're currently still in the queue, 42 of 48. So I'll let this run, and it will still be in the show notes by the time we're done, but it's not anywhere near being done yet. So I believe that wraps us up for this week's episode of RSBNB Update. Of course, a big, huge thank you again to Mod Ramen for joining us for Behind the Crown, and of course, for you, Sirion, being here on Black Friday, Thanksgiving, to fill in for Tanis and talk about and give us insight on patch notes and data center outages and whatnot. But if you want the podcast delivered automatically to you, the best way to do that is to subscribe. Subscribe on any podcast listener. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, Pocket Casts, Amazon, Stitcher, and more. You can visit update.show/subscribe and just tap on the link of your favorite. We're also on YouTube at youtube.com/RSBNB. That's where we post the full video versions of the show and the nibbles, short little segments of the show that we're splicing out. And if you like any of these, or you just want to help the channel out, like and subscribe. It greatly means the world to us. And I believe that's it for this week's episode of RSBNB Update. I'm saying this, and we'll be back next week for December's first edition of RSBNB Update.
Oh, jeez.
As we wrap up 2022. I know.
Oh, no. How is this year already over? Almost over.
Right? All right, folks. See you next week, everyone. Take care.
Bye.